Let me ask everyone to take their seats. Let me welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace and to this jointly sponsored event on crisis in Lebanon. Is peacekeeping possible? It's joint with the Middle East Institute, and it's a particular pleasure to be co-sponsoring, I'm told, for the first time. It shows you how easy it is to do a first every once in a while, an event with the Middle East Institute, and we're very pleased to do it. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And it's my role just to say a few introductory words, which will mainly be in the nature of a few announcements of upcoming events here at USIP, connected in one way or another to the Lebanon crisis. Tomorrow, from 12 to 2 in this room, we'll be discussing understanding the Iran-Hezbollah connection. On August 28th, from 2 to 4, we'll be discussing religious dimensions of conflicts in the Middle East. You can stand by for a public event as well on putting Lebanon back together. And then we are doing a book launch on September 12th. I don't have the time yet, but you'll all get announcements. A book launch for Yoram Perry's book, Generals in the Cabinet Room. So, and I'm sure Middle East Institute will be doing quite a few events as well related to, in one way or another, to the Lebanon crisis. It's a particular pleasure to welcome the Middle East Institute here, not the least because I and quite a few of my colleagues take Arabic and Farsi classes at the Middle East Institute, and we're very pleased to be able to do so. And it's a particular pleasure as well to welcome David Mack, who is vice president there, and who as a member of the U.S. Foreign Service had his advanced Arabic language training in Beirut 1968 and 69. One of the pleasures of this job is that you get to read people's bios in much more depth than you normally would. And David goes on to say he visited Lebanon numerous times during the periods of violence in 1977 as an emissary of Secretary Kissinger and during the 1980s as an aide to Ambassador Phil Habib, Ambassador Richard Murphy, and Special Presidential Envoy Donald Rumsfeld. During this period, he also served twice as Acting Deputy Chief of Mission in Beirut, and he was once Director of the State Department Office that dealt with Lebanon. So it's only wise of me, it seems, to turn over a session on Lebanon as quickly as I can to David Mack. Thank you.
My thanks to the U.S. Institute of Peace, and might just say that the Middle East Institute is an educational organization. We have a very strict non-advocacy mandate, which, however, does not restrict me in my personal capacity from being very opinionated, as I am from time to time, but don't blame the Middle East Institute, which has a broad membership, and about half of them agree with me half the time, and the other half agree with me the other half of the time. Lebanon's history and the history of peacekeeping operations in various parts of the world have a lot to tell us, I think, as we try to move from ongoing warfare to lay a foundation for lasting peace in the relations between Lebanon and Israel. Maybe I'll just use that word, sustainable peace, since it seems to be a politically correct term. Now, as it happens, I was in Beirut when the Israeli Air Force attacked the airport in 1968. Nearly four decades later, we have not resolved the intertwined problems of Israel's security, Lebanon's sovereignty and infringements on that sovereignty from various parties, and the survival and well-being of the Lebanese people. Our four panelists have on-the-ground experience in the problems of conflict resolution and peacekeeping operations, and the history of such ventures in Lebanon has not been happy, attested by both UNIFIL's mixed record and by the tragic end of efforts by the U.S., France, and Italy to stabilize Beirut's security and nurture a new government in 1982 and 1983. What lessons can we draw from international peacekeeping in other crisis areas that are relevant to this crisis? What are the pitfalls that we can avoid, and how can we do it better this time? Each panelist will speak for a maximum of 15 minutes, followed by a few brief remarks by myself on the political dynamics in Lebanon and to a certain extent with its neighbors. And then we'll have a question and answer period, an opportunity for the audience to pose questions to various panelists. The first up is Bill Stubner, and he's going to draw upon experiences working with the UN Protective Force during the Bosnian War, when he represented the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And I will just say a few words about each speaker as they come, so that particularly our C-SPAN audience will be able to put a name together with the individual who's speaking. Bill?
Thank you. It's good to be back here at the U.S. Institute of Peace and seeing all my old friends and also seeing some new friends, I hope, from the Middle East Institute. Just a very brief thing on my background, because my task here is to keep this short so that we all stay short and we really have some real discussions for a change, which doesn't happen in Washington very often. But with the experience in Bosnia, I actually went there after 5 years in El Salvador, and the last part of that, trying to help with the UN peace talks and the prosecution of the murder trial in the case of the Jesuit murders. So I decided it was time to do something else. I first entered Bosnia in the spring of 1992. I was involved in setting up the humanitarian airlift for Sarajevo. I worked at that time for the Department of Defense, but then for the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. But at the same time was dual-hatted by State Department to report on war crimes. Went from there in 1994 to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague and helped to organize and supervise field investigations for war crimes. From there went to help set up the OSCE mission, from which I returned to the War Crimes Tribunal and got involved in the mass grave exhumations for the Srebrenica massacre. During that period, in that very checkered career, I got to know just about all of the UNPROFOR commanders, the UN Protection Force commanders in Bosnia. And some of them were really outstanding people, some of them were not so good, but I think I took away a lot of lessons from those conversations with them. First of all, I want to say the 1990s, although there was a lot of peacekeeping, it wasn't a good time for peacekeeping. And the culmination of that in the year 2000 was the Brahimi report that was written by Lakhdar Brahimi and some of his helpers on how we ought to improve peacekeeping. And I would have to say, with my experience in Bosnia, at the very best, we can say the peacekeeping experience in Bosnia was a qualified failure. Anyway, I'd like to just very briefly run through some of the principles I think that you need to consider for whether or not a peacekeeping experience can be successful. The principles that I kind of gleaned from watching this over almost a decade in the Balkans was, number one, national interests always trump international interests, whether it's the national interests of the players on the ground or the people who contribute to peacekeeping. National interests will always take the first place, and I heard this time after time from UNPROFOR commanders. You'd have a British commander who would complain that the French commander always passed every one of his orders back to Paris before he would obey it to get Paris's approval. And I'm not picking on the French. That's just the case with all these countries. If you even want to look all the way to the political level of the UN Security Council, I would say the one more successful peacekeeping operation in the Balkans was the one that took place in Macedonia, which is where the Americans had troops on the ground. We had an infantry battalion. It was working very well, and the Chinese refused to allow it to continue because the Macedonians had committed the sacrilege of recognizing Taiwan. So national interests will always trump international interests. Number two, the mandate of the peacekeeping mission has to be clear and unambiguous. And it has all the players have to know what that is. They've got to have clear orders, and they have to carry them out without exception. Otherwise, you end up creating false expectations, and sometimes those lead to disaster. Frankly, with the Srebrenica massacre, I helped to dig up the results of failed peacekeeping, because we had created what were called UMPAs, UN protective areas, and they were not. There was not the capability to protect them, and there was not the will to protect them. But you give a false impression that you're going to do something that you really can't do. So you have to be very clear on that. The third thing I would say is you've got to have unity of command. In Bosnia, we have what was called a dual key approach on airstrikes. You had the UN special representative for the Secretary General, along with the military types and the people with a chain up to NATO. They both had to agree on an airstrike. Mostly they were only called in when UN forces came under fire. But even then, very often, they did not come, and they were promised for Srebrenica. The Dutch thought airstrikes were coming. Give another example in that same area. The General Ritterstad, the Swedish general who ran the Swedish task force, which was really outstanding, five times he requested airstrikes when his own soldiers came under fire. And he never got any of those airstrikes. The sixth time around, he had the best tanks in the region. He had his tank unit fire more than 80 main gun rounds back at the Drina Corps. That task force was never shot at again. He couldn't get the airstrikes which were promised, so he took action himself. Resources, and this is the biggest lesson, I think, from the Brahimi report. Brahimi basically told the Secretary General, if the Security Council gives you a mission for peacekeeping and doesn't give you the means with which to carry it out, then you've got to stand up and say, no, we can't do this peacekeeping mission. And that's very hard to do, because you want to try to help in the conflict. But the kinds of things that we saw in Bosnia at the peak in former Yugoslavia, we had about 38,000 peacekeepers. We never had anything approaching the numbers that were estimated that were needed. Also, countries would donate their troops very often with the expectation, number one, not only would they get $1,000 per month per man, which they rarely then turned over to the troops, but also that if they showed up with no equipment, the UN would have to equip them. Examples of this, Ukrainians showed up with no helmets. And the day after they arrived, three of their soldiers died from head wounds from an artillery round because of not having any helmets. So, of course, the UN has to rush in and provide helmets. The Bangladeshi battalion, when they came in, had one rifle for every four men and no radios with which to call an airstrike, even if they needed one. So they had to be armed. The Pakistani battalion that came in with almost nothing, and the UN had to equip them then primarily with excess East and West German equipment. And it was a little bit disconcerting out in the woods near Tuzla to see a member of the Pakistani battalion wearing basically German sweaters with German flags on them and German name tags, but it was because they came with almost nothing. So resources, you've got to have it. The sine qua non and the thing that you've got to have is will. Even if you have everything else in place, if there isn't a will on the part of the warring parties to actually have peace, then there's no peace to keep. You've got to have a will of the international community writ large that they're actually going to take action. You've got to have the will on the part of the national contingents that they will take the action that are necessary under their mandate. Without that will, no matter what you do, you can fix all the nuts and bolts. If you don't have the will to do what you need to do, to help make peace, then you're just not going to get anything done. Towards closing, I want to say peacekeeping is nearly always mission impossible, no matter how good your intentions are, because of all these other pitfalls that you can fall into. It's almost always mission impossible. But that said, I want to say it's very easy to be negative. You know, the naysayers can always be negative. They can always say the UN can't do this. They can always say it's impossible to accomplish these things in the Middle East. Well, if that's the case, we might as well just throw up our hands and go home. And I don't think any of us want to do that. The last point I'll make, and this has to do another thing with will, is the primary actors who are not the warring parties have got to be brought into the process, and they have to be given a motivation for the peacekeeping mission to work. And who would I say those primary players are in this case? Number one certainly would be Syria. This peacekeeping mission is going to be involved with demilitarizing Hezbollah and also making sure that it's not rearmed. Well, if you cannot control the border with Syria, I would say it's humanly impossible to completely control it. And so if you don't bring them on and if you don't talk to them and find a way to motivate them, whether it's with carrots or sticks, this, I think, cannot work. In the Bosnian case, quite frankly, both the Croatian government and the Serbian government, or at that time called the Yugoslavian government, were a negative factor in the peacekeeping mission. And we never really brought them on board. So you've got to look for their interests. Anyway, I hope that we'll keep it short so that we can have a good discussion period. And on the optimistic note, I hope during the discussion period we can actually come up with some ideas here on how to make this work. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you for setting a good example of concise, to-the-point presentation. Next speaker is Mike Bailey, a retired U.S. Army officer. In the course of 25 years in U.S. military service, Colonel Bailey served in various capacities with the U.S. Department of Defense, dealing with peacekeeping and humanitarian operations.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon, and sincerely appreciate the opportunity to participate in what I think is a timely and very important discussion. Just wanted to highlight, just to provide a few more details why I'm standing up here. I've been asked this afternoon to discuss disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of Hezbollah. I've been asked, based on experience starting in 1992 in Cambodia, where I disarmed and demobilized 10,000 Cambodian soldiers, worked out in Haiti in support of the UN, most recently in East Timor, where I negotiated a disarmament agreement of the Falantil, and then developed the modalities for disarmament, and in the very recent past was contracted to provide policy procedure plans, assistance to ORHA to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate the Iraqi military. Based on these experiences, practical experiences, just want to go over just a couple lessons learned. DDR is essential to creating the conditions for long-term stability, sustainable peace. Requires comprehensive, coordinated, integrated approach, especially on funding. Requires adequate financial logistical support prior to the implementation. Efficient planning implementation supervisory structures should be in place and operational prior to the cessation of hostilities. Demobilization tracking mechanisms are necessary. Transparency strengthens regional national trust and confidence. The process must be flexible. We've discovered that the average cost per soldier is about $100. Post-demobilization disarmament mechanisms are useful, such as weapons turn-in, weapons for development, etc. Concurrently, steps should be taken to prevent a gap in public security. And as we're seeing now, the process must address irregular forces and weapons. The good news is the Security Council resolution addresses disarmament. It tasks UNIFIL specifically to take all necessary action in areas of deployment of its forces. It also recognizes the role of the government of Lebanon and the Lebanese armed forces. Moreover, the Security Council resolution really pins the rose, if you will, on the Secretary General to develop the modalities for DDR. And that's where we're starting to see positions being staked out. The Minister of Defense of Lebanon just was recently quoted saying, as the Lebanese armed forces will not disarm Hezbollah. We're starting, but moreover, he said it should be part of a national dialogue. So we're starting to see positions as the Secretary General embarks upon a very long and difficult journey to develop the modalities, if you will, for the disarmament, demobilization, or reintegration of Hezbollah, and then turning those modalities into reality. I would offer the coming days and weeks will be very telling as these discussions unfold. Moreover, what actions UNIFIL and the Lebanese armed forces are going to be taking on the ground to deal with Hezbollah's infrastructure in southern Lebanon. A few ideas to help create the conditions to enable the Secretary General to develop these modalities. Meetings at the field level are going to take place. I can tell you from my experience in Cambodia, I met with a local Khmer Rouge battalion commander. These forces are in close proximity. These meetings are going to take place. These meetings are important, and they should take place. However, the UN headquarters in New York and the force headquarters, UNIFIL force headquarters in the region, has to provide very clear guidance on to the forces to enable these meetings to bear fruit. The bottom line is to build confidence on the ground of the parties. Liaison mechanisms. Liaison mechanisms in the early days are going to be important to facilitate communication as well as resolve tensions. Miscommunication is going to be a problem. I'm pretty confident saying that there's not a lot of trust between the parties in the region. So the more liaison, the more transparency we have, the more confidence will begin to be built. International community should conduct a donors conference. A donors conference perhaps specifically pointed towards disarmament, demobilization, reintegration of Hezbollah. As I mentioned earlier, one of the key lessons learned is funding for DDR. It is an expensive, timely undertaking. If the funding is not there, the process will begin to break down. And these soldiers, Hezbollah soldiers, if you will, these weapons are their source of authority. You have to give them something else to break that. Lastly, would offer a strong information campaign. The UN, the international community, has to get word out to the local Lebanese what's going on, how the process is going to unfold. Hazards of not doing DDR. Hezbollah retains the initiative. The UN is left in a difficult position with no exit strategy, no chance to complete the transformation of Hezbollah, no weapons control, acts of vengeance. We've already seen leaders of Hezbollah saying that we're going to talk to those who weren't very supportive of us during the 30 days. Weak or no trust in the process. Difficulty for humanitarian organizations operating, and then, moreover, the return to hostilities is almost certain. In closing, would like just to offer that the DDR process is politically, institutionally, and logistically complex. However, DDR creates breathing space, requires competent planning and management, is a long-term undertaking, and transparency is essential. Again, thank you, and I look forward to discussion.
Thank you, Mike. Our next speaker is Jim Dobbins. Ambassador Dobbins was Assistant Secretary for Europe and also held senior White House and State Department positions dealing with the Balkans, Haiti, Somalia, Afghanistan, and the European community, which at least was perhaps wouldn't exactly qualify as a troubled spot, but I suppose that provided its own share of danger at various times for you, Jim. He will speak from his broad range of experience.
Thanks. Well, I'm certainly not an expert on Lebanon, but I will talk a bit based on my personal experience with Somalia, Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, and then research that we've conducted at the RAND Corporation over the last several years on both American and UN performance in nation building and peacekeeping. First, I'd like to clarify a few phrases and talk about what this mission is and isn't. One of the phrases is nation building. This is the use of armed force in the aftermath of a conflict to promote a series of economic and political reforms that allows a strengthened government to secure its own territory. Second is peace enforcement. This is an intervention over the objection of one or more of the parties in order to compel a cessation of hostilities and prevent a return. Third is peacekeeping, which presumes the agreement and acquiescence of the parties. And the last is counterinsurgency. The mission, as it's described in the Security Council resolution, could theoretically involve all of these, but I think that for the most part it is not nation building, peace enforcement, or counterinsurgency. It is principally peacekeeping. The resolution calls for the force to support the government of Lebanon, not to reform it. And its support for the government of Lebanon is very limited. It's to support its assertion of authority in a geographically limited area. And therefore, while it has a slight component of nation building, it's a very limited one. Secondly, it does appear to authorize the use of force, but it authorizes it under a article of the UN Charter that doesn't authorize the UN to use force. Read carefully, the only authorization to use force is to use force at the request of the government of Lebanon. Therefore, the force, to the extent it chooses to do so, may use force when requested by the government of Lebanon and otherwise not at all under any circumstances except for its own protection. So again, it's not peace enforcement, or at least it's a very limited sort of peace enforcement. The third phrase, which I think is the most applicable, is peacekeeping. And last is it's definitely not counterinsurgency. It's not a force which is going to employ force in order to suppress Hezbollah and to force its disarmament and dismantling. And it's not realistic to think it could. The United States, 160,000 American soldiers have been unable to do in Iraq, and 20,000 Israeli soldiers were unable to do in southern Lebanon, is not going to be done by 15,000 risk-adverse Euros. Therefore, it's definitely not a counterinsurgency force. It's principally a peacekeeping force of the traditional Cold War interpositional sort, and it's worth looking at what the track record is and the conditions of success or failure of a force of that sort. First, the UN role in peacekeeping is actually a fairly positive one. Most UN peacekeeping missions succeed. We shouldn't presume just because it's a UN mission that it's destined for failure. And the UN also has a record of some success in the area of peace enforcement in the Belgian Congo in the 60s and Eastern Slavonia in the mid-90s and East Timor. But those missions required a very high degree of international consensus behind the operation, international consensus which certainly doesn't exist in these circumstances. Now, the UN chain of command is formally quite clear. It runs from the force commander to the civilian representative of the Secretary General in place to the Secretary General. And in principle, the decision to use force and how to use force will be made not by the force commander, but by the civilian representative of the Secretary General in consultation with New York. As a practical matter, however, the rules of engagement for this force are going to be set by the nations that make it up, and they're likely to vary very significantly from one contingent to another. The force is likely to be commanded by the French. A record in this regard, judged by their performance in Kosovo, where they've had the most difficult sector, the sector with most of the Serbs in it and with most of the conflict in it, suggests that they would be extremely conservative in terms of the use of force to do anything except protect their own personnel. There are obviously interpositional forces that have been quite successful. One thinks of the force in Cyprus, which has preserved the peace there for more than 30 years, or the observer force in the Sinai. The conditions, of course, for those forces to succeed is that the parties to the conflict want them to succeed and don't want to renew the conflict. Interpositional forces prevent mishaps. They prevent misunderstandings. They prevent mistakes. They don't prevent intentional conflict. If one side or the other intends a conflict, the force does nothing but document that event. And that's the most that can be expected of this force, is to prevent an accidental conflict arising from an unintended confluence between Israeli and Hezbollah forces in the region. What can the force do? From the Israeli standpoint, they're worried about two principal things, raids and rockets. The force, if largely a 15,000-man international force, if it concentrates on the border between Israel and Lebanon, can probably prevent raids or make them much more difficult, not by forcibly attacking Hezbollah raiders, but simply by warning the Israelis if they're coming, in which case the Israelis will be prepared and they won't be able to sneak in and kidnap soldiers. So the force can probably do that at no risk to itself. On the other hand, going through a much larger area and securing rocket launch sites and disarming Hezbollah is probably well beyond the capacity of this force or the intention of any of the countries that are going to commit forces to it. I think where are we going? Clearly, this force was part of a complex set of compromises designed to bring a conflict to the close. And I think both the U.S., the Israelis, the Hezbollah, and others need to draw appropriate conclusions from that conflict, and we don't yet know what the conclusions they have drawn are, and so we're not sure how they're going to behave as they seek to implement this Security Council resolution. The general rule on dealing with insurgencies is insurgents win if they don't lose, and governments lose if they don't win. By that criteria, Hezbollah won, Israel lost, and to the extent the United States position coincided with Israel, the United States lost, and it's very difficult to disguise that. Now, there are two logical conclusions one could draw from this. One is that the current policy isn't working, and we're going to have to try a new approach, one which, as one of the other speakers suggested, engages all the parties in the region, begins a broader dialogue, tries to solve some of the underlying problems. The alternate solution is, well, the policy was right, it simply wasn't pursued vigorously enough, We went after the Iranian surrogate. That didn't work. Let's go directly to the source. And I suspect that there is a debate in Washington and probably in Israel as well as to which of these courses of action is the appropriate lesson to be drawn from the experience of the last month.
Thank you, Jim. Next up is Art Hughes. Ambassador Hughes was Director General of the Multinational Force and Observers, an example that the last speaker mentioned as being one of the more successful examples of peacekeeping. And that was in charge of Egyptian-Arab peacekeeping in the Sinai Peninsula. In his long diplomatic career, Art served as ambassador to Yemen, but he was also DCM in Tel Aviv. Another reason for having him here as a speaker, Art.
Thank you, Clack, for clapping when I come up to the podium. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate today. It was my privilege to serve the MFO and Egypt and Israel in the cause of peace for 6 years as Director General of this very unique organization. It is so unique, in fact, some might think it's not relevant to the situation up north and things we're talking about today. But I'll go quickly through some of the activities of the MFO, some of the way it's organized and operates, and I think there are some lessons learned from the experience of the MFO that do have some application. First of all, the MFO is unique because it was created by the two parties themselves. The 1979 Treaty of Peace between Egypt and Israel provided that the UN would do the peacekeeping operation. However, by May of 1981, it was clear the Security Council could not agree on a mandate. The Soviet Union threatened to veto a mandate. So the two parties, together with the United States, got together in August of 1981, created a protocol to the peace treaty that set up the MFO, the Multinational Force and Observers, taking those words out of the treaty itself. That situation had been foreseen, and President Carter had written letters to President Begin and Prime Minister Begin and President Sadat in March of 79 when the treaty was signed, promising to help them set up an independent PKO if the UN couldn't do the job. So the protocol and the treaty themselves became the mandate of the MFO. And the mandate is a very strong one. It's very clear, and it built on the experiences, both good and bad, of previous PKOs in the region, including UNEF and what happened in May and June of 1967. For example, there are two key sentences in the treaty and the protocol that I think give the flavor. First, in the protocol itself, it says that the task of the MFO is to supervise the implementation of the security provisions of the treaty and to employ best efforts to ensure no violations thereof. And going back to the treaty, in the portion that set up the liaison system, it said that the task of the liaison system was to resolve problems, assess the progress and implementation of the security provisions of the treaty, and to refer upwards any problems that they couldn't resolve at that level. Now, the protocol also set out a lot of details about operations, observation posts, checkpoints, very detailed intrusive verifications, including schedules for verification. And it also became the constitution of the MFO because it gave it a legal personality, created the various jobs of Director General and the Force Commander, and it gave the Director General basic plenipotentiary power to do whatever the Director General thought should be done, which turned out to be rather key at various times in the life of the MFO. Also, in setting up the liaison system, which became a very critical part of the MFO, it required that the parties set up liaison offices at specific locations designated and to designate senior officers who then would have to be in touch, would have to make themselves available to the other side of the MFO. It also enabled the Director General to convoke senior officials of both sides at a place that he chose within 48 hours, if necessary. Never was necessary to do that because of the way the liaison system worked. and a very fundamental point, and that is that other speakers referred to, and that is Egypt and Israel want the MFO to work because they want their treaty to work. Now, the treaty in its security provisions based itself on the concept of providing continued strategic depth for Israel as it left the Sinai. So it basically set up security zones, three security zones in Sinai and one in Israel. For political reasons, there had to be one in Israel as well. But working from the west toward the east, Zone A in Sinai allowed one mechanized infantry division, 22,000 men and associated equipment. Zone B down the middle of Sinai allowed no military but four battalions of border guards. Zone C along the Israel border allowed no military but only civil police. Zone D in Israel, four battalions, associated equipment, but no tanks, no artillery, except shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles. But also, protocol set up a very detailed intrusive inspection system for verifications and confidence building, and as I said, mandated direct contacts between senior representatives of the two parties. Now, the MFO, just very briefly, is set up headquarters in Rome because neither party wanted to be in the other country, and the Italians came forward and offered Rome. There's a small headquarters there, 22 people, led by the director general, the normal people you'd expect, operations and planning, a general counsel, human resources, IT, engineering, and so forth. 22 people, less than half the size it was at the beginning. In Cairo and Tel Aviv, there are director general representatives who represent on a daily basis the MFO to the host government and also maintain contacts with the 11 countries which provide soldiers to the MFO and the four countries that provide additional financial support. And most importantly, in some respects, they run purchasing offices because the MFO spends about half of its budget purchasing items locally in Egypt and in Israel. The force in the Sinai is located in Zone C with 22 fixed emplacements, headquarters in the north and a sub-headquarters in the south, 1,700 soldiers, 11 countries. Headquarters is led by a force commander, a two-star, now an Italian, major general. The force commander is appointed by the director general with approval of the parties. He has a staff of six branches, operations, liaison, IT, HR, so forth, support as you'd expect. And three infantry battalions on the ground, a support battalion including fixed-wing aviation and rotary-wing aviation as well. The O and MFO, the observers, a civilian observer unit, 15 people, all Americans as desired by the parties, about half seconded from the Foreign Service, the United States, State Department, and half direct hire retired military people with direct experience doing the kinds of inspections that are done on a periodic basis. Now, according to both of the parties, the MFO has met their needs, and this was shown very clearly in 2001 when Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld wanted to reduce the American military participation in the MFO from about 800 soldiers to 27. Both governments pushed back at the administration, and over a period of a couple of years, finally, a relatively small reduction in the American force was implemented, but the U.S. Army is still 41% of the MFO. Now, just going quickly, why has the MFO been successful, been able to do the job? Well, the most significant reason is because Israel and Egypt want the MFO to be successful. They want the security provisions of their treaty to work on the ground. It meets their national security needs. The MFO acts as a verifier, a witness, provides mutual assurance, facilitates problem solving, and builds confidence. Secondly, the MFO has a very strong and clear mandate. As I said, built on the experiences of earlier peace operations in the region. Third, the MFO is independent. Being not a part of the UN, actually, in this context, was very useful because it contains problems. The Director General reports only to the parties. Therefore, when there are issues, when there are misunderstandings, when there are things going on that perhaps shouldn't be going on, it's all contained internally within the family. which precludes then a lot of political posturing and the need to make grand statements that people have trouble backing down from afterward. Third, the MFO has had adequate resources, and it's used them very wisely. There are annual audits by an outside auditor, which goes through, makes sure that correct use of resources is being made. And for 11 years, the MFO was able to maintain a constant $51 million budget. It's just gone up for two reasons: replacement of old helicopters with more complex Black Hawks and additional requirements on force protection. Third, the MFO has been flexible because it's independent, can set up its own rules, set up its own way of doing things. And when there's a need for a change, for example, when Israel and Egypt decided that border guards were needed in Zone C opposite Gaza when Israel left, Israel and Egypt sat down, worked out an arrangement that they agreed on, then invited the MFO in to comment, make suggestions, and then give the MFO its marching orders how to proceed. There was no need for change in the treaty or the protocol. These were discussed in the parliaments of both countries and approved, and the MFO went to work. Also, until very recently, the MFO operated in a very benign environment. Not a shot had been fired in anger by either the parties or the MFO, and this meant that it was a very comfortable place for soldiers and civilians to work. Unfortunately, recently, you've all read about the terrorist attacks in the Sinai, a couple of which had actually been aimed at the MFO. Fortunately, no serious harm done to the MFO itself, but this has meant a redoubling of effort on that side of things. Quickly, lessons to learn. Commitment of the parties is critical, and not only the commitment politically, but the ability and the will to compel compliance within their own countries. There's also a useful aspect here because the fact that a PKO is there in this kind of environment also tends to take the subject matter off the political agenda in the countries involved. Need a strong and detailed mandate and also a strong and detailed concept of operations. And that's where they are, I think, in Beirut now. Where do they take paragraphs 11 and 12 from 1701 and turn it into a concept of operations? And that's going to be very, very difficult, particularly given the compromises that are going to have to be made between the government of Lebanon and probably in Hezbollah. And third, non-bureaucratic, flexible, nimble, and very professional organization that can respond to situations as they change, situation as it develops between the two treaty parties, and to meet their needs, not simply to stick to the needs of the words in the protocol or the treaty, but to be responsive to the parties and what they need. Because as in the case of the MFO, I think it's fair to say the MFO has become a partner with the two treaty parties in implementation of the security provisions of a treaty, building confidence, and serving the cause of stability and peace between the two countries. So thank you very much, and look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Well, as the last speaker suggested, there may be some dissonance between the situation we face in Lebanon, Lebanon-Israel context, and the one that he was dealing with in the Egypt-Israel context. And one of those differences is that the Lebanese government is weak. On the positive side, it's not an autocratic government. What if we had a weak autocracy? We don't have that. Lebanon's last elections were relatively free. It has a long history of constitutionalism, longer than any country in the Middle East, really. And it has a very strong civil society, robust civil society, dynamic. So you would think that this is that opportunity for freedom and democracy that the Bush administration and lots of people, lots of Democrats as well, have been longing for in the Middle East. Unfortunately, Lebanon has an even longer history of political instability, personal insecurity, inability to control its borders. And you put those factors together with some very intrusive neighbors, and it's enough to give democracy a bad name. Now, 2 days ago, President Bush said that Hezbollah suffered a defeat because there's going to be a new power in the south of Lebanon, and that's going to be a Lebanese force with a robust international force to help them seize control of the country. Well, it's doubtful that international peacekeeping, even the modest peacekeeping that's suggested by the current resolution, is going to be sustainable, let alone a peace between, long-term peace between Israel and Lebanon that will be sustainable, unless it is a first step that makes it possible to move on to some political agreements and to material support that build up stronger Lebanese government institutions. The Lebanese army is going to have to become much stronger. It's even to reach the level that we see in neighboring Syria, which manages to maintain control very well behind an UNDOF force on the Golan Heights, and has done that now for decades. I would suspect much to the mutual satisfaction of both Syria and Israel, even though they don't like to express great pride in it publicly. But the Lebanese government isn't there. And the Lebanese government won't get there unless they have some kind of Lebanese deal, an internal political accommodation. As has been noted by a couple of speakers, the Lebanese government is not going to go to war with Hezbollah. That won't happen. And it's also clear that a strategy that relied upon making life so painful for Lebanese and destroying so much civilian infrastructure in Lebanon, that this would somehow move the Lebanese in the direction of going to war with Hezbollah, that strategy has manifestly failed. Now, on the international side, Syria has been a part of the problem. But it does not follow that Syria cannot be part of the solution. Just as, in a way, Hezbollah can be part of the solution internally. Because the internal Lebanese deal, if there is one to be had, is going to amount to Hezbollah disarmament, more or less, at least disarmament of any blatant Hezbollah armed activities, and ceding to the Lebanese government the authority to exercise sovereignty in all matters regarding arms. But they're going to want something in return, and that's going to be a greater share in power in the Lebanese government. They already have two cabinet members, but to a certain extent, they have been marginalized in the current governing coalition. Now, on the Syrian side, as I say, it simply doesn't follow that Syria, which has played some very bad roles in the past, it simply doesn't follow that it cannot be part of the solution. In fact, I would maintain it probably has to be part of the solution if it's going to be a sustainable solution. There are some things that Syria wants, objectives in regard to Lebanon, that are quite different from Iran's, far more defensive in nature. Syria wants to see Israel's eventual withdrawal from the Golan. Syria desires better relations with the United States. And Syria needs a Lebanese neighbor that is not hostile to Syria's economic and security interests. Within a diplomatic process, which currently doesn't exist, these factors can be motivations for Syrian cooperation in impeding the resupply of arms to Hezbollah. But public threats and a futile effort to isolate the Syrian government have been unhelpful, aside from gratuitously hobbling the effectiveness of U.S. diplomacy in this crisis. Whatever the rationale for Syria's decision to cede to Lebanon its claim over the Sheba Farms area, this has provided an additional opportunity to build up the reputation of the Lebanese government. Hezbollah has tried for a decade now to liberate the Sheba farms, or at least almost a decade, and manifestly has not succeeded in doing so. If there isn't an international agreement involving Syria, as it would have to, in some way, but particularly key to this is Israel, if there's an international agreement for the withdrawal of Israeli forces and Lebanese forces to take control of the border in the Sheba Farms area, that would obviously build up the reputation of the Lebanese government of Prime Minister Senyora. And so it would demonstrate that international diplomacy succeeded where terrorism had failed. Just as Anwar Sadat was able to demonstrate that international diplomacy enabled Egypt to regain the Sinai Peninsula. Aside from the Israeli occupation, one of the reasons why Hezbollah emerged in 1982 and flourished politically in the following two decades was the failure of the government of Beirut to provide economic and social safety net for the deprived elements of Lebanon's Shia plurality. Instead, it was Hezbollah that took upon itself this role. The race is now on between the international community, with a scheduled donor conference in Stockholm at the end of the month, and Hezbollah with Iranian financial backing. Who is going to become the hero of the post-war period for that 1 million internally displaced Lebanese? And one would have to say that at this point in that race, Hezbollah is clearly in the lead. All you have to look at the front pages of today's New York Times and Washington Post. Aside from humanitarian aid, the Lebanese economy has been dealt a body blow, and the billions of dollars required for economic reconstruction are not going to becoming in the short term, at least, from private Lebanese capitalists. So that's another challenge for sustainable peacekeeping. Before we move to the question period, there is somebody in the audience who has been involved in many more Lebanese-Israeli crises than me, and he's also a former president of the U.S. Institute of Peace. Sam, would you have any words you'd like to offer at this point? Why don't you come up here where you can use the microphone, Sam? Yeah, this is former Ambassador Samuel Lewis.
Thanks, David. I want to say first that I think Jim Dobbins said most of what I would want to hear. And if you listen carefully to his speech, you really heard what you need to know about the dilemma everybody's in. I was struck by his comment about the French being very conservative in Bosnia in their use of force. I was ambassador in Israel during the first Lebanon-Israeli war, one of the more unpleasant parts of my life. Before that, I had been ambassador during the peace treaty with Egypt and Israel, one of the happier times in my life. But one has to remember that UNIFIL has been there since 1978. It's not a new invention. And there's a plethora of experience of how a UN force undermanned and with a very weak peacekeeping-type mandate can do in that situation that's been well described in the press and here this morning. But one thing that has been forgotten is that the French were the first commanders of UNIFIL, and they had a very tough para with Algerian experience as head of it. And he started out with robust peacekeeping on his mind. And in the first clash with the PLO irregulars, who were the problem for the MFO for UNIFIL in that early era, he launched quite a lot of retaliatory attacks on the PLO bases. They fought back shortly thereafter and so severely wounded him that he had to be withdrawn back to France. And the moment of French robustness in peacekeeping came to an end with that event in Lebanon. So there's a long history to the French being quite careful about how much violence they use against irregular forces. And I think we'll see that replicated if they lead the force in South Lebanon. Second is that as I read that resolution, obviously a complicated compromise and a diplomatic triumph in some ways against great odds even to get it done, the peacekeeping mandate is actually almost identical to the mandate that UNIFIL has had for the last 26 years or however long they've been there. There really is not much difference, except it'll be bigger. Instead of 2,000, you'll have 15,000. But the dependence on helping the Lebanese government was intrinsic to the initial mandate of UNIFIL. So it all comes back to what you think the Lebanese government will really try to do in South Lebanon. And for the reasons that have been well discussed, the Hezbollah is so embedded in Lebanese society, civil and governmental at this point, and are also negotiating today, I gather from the newspapers, for an arrangement under which they will withdraw some fighters maybe up north, and the Lebanese army will be permitted to come into that area so long as they don't dig around and look for any arms caches and get too curious about what's being left behind. If that's the deal, and I suspect it will be the deal, the Israelis, needless to say, aren't going to be very reassured by the robustness of this international force. And the fact the international force won't have a mandate to do anything except help defend itself, of course, and help the Lebanese do something they will not be trying to do, makes me pretty pessimistic about the future of peacekeeping in South Lebanon. Above all, as both my friend Art and Jim have said, the key is if the two parties want to keep the peace, a UN peacekeeping force can be very effective. If either one of them doesn't, it's a very nasty job to give anybody.
Okay, a person wishing to ask questions should line up behind the microphone over there. And to maximize the opportunity for others, I would ask that you limit yourself to a single question, a single part question, or a very, very brief remark. And as a courtesy to the speakers and the audience, I would like you to identify yourself by name and affiliation if you wish. So please.
Al Milliken, Washington Independent Writers. I see the Middle East Institute has a paper addressing medical metaphors in the Middle East, including eradicating, cauterizing, or surgically removing a cancer. How significantly do any of you think language will be playing a role in peacekeeping? Are these medical metaphors and labels such as terrorist, Islamist, fascist, and axis of evil helping or hurting the cause of peace?
Who'd like to take a stab at that? Maybe one of our former diplomats, like you, Jim, who have a sense of the degree to which language has to match the fist that's hopefully in a velvet glove.
As regards the war on terrorism, I've been more concerned about martial metaphors than medical metaphors. We're labeling Al-Qaeda a global insurgency. We're talking about the campaign against Al-Qaeda as a war. And we've constantly looked for military models and military analogies to explain what we're facing and what we're doing. This is very useful for mobilizing American public opinion, but it's not very useful for mobilizing public opinion in most of the rest of the world, who don't tend to regard this as primarily a military enterprise, and who tend to react negatively to our using those types of terms. And I do think that at some point this or some administration is going to have to establish a better balance between the kind of rhetoric which secures domestic support and the kind of rhetoric which could secure much greater international support.
Do you want to add to that, Art?
Yeah, just one. I mean, what Jim said is exactly right. It's no longer possible. these days to talk to just one audience. When you talk, when leaders talk, they're talking to the whole world. So it's very difficult to do a put out language that achieves all your objectives. But I just want to say, I think it's very careful, important to be very careful about words. One of the problems that Ehud Olmert has right now is, at the very beginning, he set some very high objectives, none of which have been achieved.
Good afternoon. Tom Lippman, Middle East Institute. I was in Vietnam in 73 when an international force was deployed to supervise the implementation of the Paris Agreement. And that force was 25% Indonesian on the theory that there had to be some Asians, and was 25% Hungarian on the theory that there had to be some communists. And although really all the Hungarians wanted was to get paid in hard currency, but that's another subject. And in South Lebanon in 78, when I was there, I seem to recall that that initial deployment included Iranians on the theory that there had to be some Muslims. And I'd like to know what members of the panel think about whether there should be or must be some presumed empathy or affinity between the participants in the international force and the people whom they're going in there to work with.
Art, why don't you take a stab at that first?
The MFO has 11 countries providing troops from all over. Fijians, Hungarians, Colombians, Uruguayans, French, Dutch originally. And I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference. You want to make the receiving states comfortable about who is there, but if you have a strong organization, a strong force commander, and strong control with unity of command, I think I remember who was it mentioned unity of command, you've got to have one concept of operations, you've got to have one ROE, you've got a one standard discipline, and impose it on them. And if each one of these groups can show they can do the job and they're professional and well-disciplined, then I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference, frankly. At least that's my experience on the ground.
Jim?
Tom, I think it depends a lot on what you want the force to do. I think the two examples you gave weren't spectacularly successful, as I recall. I think if you want the force to be a sort of a neutral interpositional force, which simply calls strikes and balls and prevents misadventures but doesn't try to interfere with intentional violence, then a neutral party that doesn't speak the local language and doesn't have a cultural affinity is probably adequate and maybe even superior. If you were looking at this force to actually conduct a counterinsurgency campaign, if you were looking for a force that would actually forcefully root Hezbollah out of the area, then the only international force which would have the slightest prospect of success would be one made up mostly of Algerians and Egyptians and Moroccans and others who've dealt with their own insurgents, who speak the language, and who can apply those lessons effectively in a culturally similar environment.
Bill?
Just one example of how this played out in Bosnia was when the Turkish battalion arrived. The UN, first of all, made a mistake. They were going to bring them in on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo Polje, which wasn't a good perception type thing, where you were going to have a Turkish infantry battalion coming back to Bosnia. But when that was delayed by a couple of weeks, they were deployed to what was considered one of the more hardcore Muslim areas, which, you know, it was kind of a misnomer in Bosnia anyway, but they were deployed to Zenica. They have a very smart commander. The first thing he did in Zenica, because everyone had the perception that he was going to come in pro-Muslim, the first thing he did was go and renovate the Catholic Church. You know, he used his soldiers to do that, and then he renovated the mosque. But also at that time, we had an organization headquartered in Zenica that called itself Hamas, that was abusing Croats, abusing Catholics, and kind of ethnically cleansing them out of the area. This guy took, you know, and perhaps he was the one that could do it, he took extremely tough measures against that element, even to the point of surrounding their headquarters one night, dragging them all out, lining them up against the wall in the headlights, and telling them in perfect Arabic, if any of this continued, he would come back and kill every one of them. He had a great deal of credibility, so sometimes, but they ended up doing a wonderful job.
Yeah.
And they did it by actually playing the other side.
Well, I think it's relevant to mention that there's been lots of discussion that the Turks will provide forces for this occasion, and there's a lot of complications. It's a tremendously complicated decision for the Turkish government. complicated by Iraq, their neighboring Iraq, complicated by the Sunni-Shia issues. But the one thing they do bring is, in addition to a certain amount of perhaps cultural sensitivity, they do bring a very professional NATO military. So they may end up being quite critical to whether this is successful.
Clayton Swisher, also with the Middle East Institute. Listening to the U.S. administration, one gets the impression that this conflict started on July 12th with Hezbollah's kidnapping of the two soldiers. But I want to know to what extent you on the panel, see this as the root cause. It seems the administration wants to work in reverse chronological order in terms of enforcing U.N. Security Council resolutions, whether they be 1701 or 1559. Or other agreements like TIFE, but to what extent do you see the implementation of earlier resolutions, namely 242 and 338, which as Ambassador Hughes described the peace between Israel and Egypt, which is based on a full implementation and an end of Israeli occupation of Egyptian lands, paved the way for a real peacekeeping operation. I don't hear anyone emphasizing the implementation or addressing of these root causes, and I wanted to know what your views on it were.
Well, let me just respond to that MEI response to an MEI question.
We have this debate all the time, though.
Yeah, I know. But let's have it for the public now so they'll know we don't have one opinion at the Middle East Institute. I would say that there are plenty of UN resolutions dealing with Lebanon and dealing with the Lebanese-Israeli border and, for that matter, a UN-demarcated border that was transgressed by Hezbollah on the 12th of July, for us not to have to go all the way back to Genesis for root causes. So I would say that that for me the verdict is still out on why Hezbollah did this, and the answers that have been provided so far not very are either implausible to me or very worrisome. But as I say, that's not to say that Hezbollah's own interests and concerns don't have to be taken into account, at least in the internal Lebanese domestic deal that I believe has to be part of any sustainable resolution here.
I think it's pretty easy to explain why Hezbollah did it.
Take a shot at
that. Because Hamas had done it, and they weren't going to be second-rate resistance movement, and therefore emulated Hamas and did the same thing.
Art?
Well, I think the G8 summit declaration of July 16th said it exactly right, which President Bush signed on to, and of course State Department people, and as I understand the reports that Secretary Rice had a direct hand in drafting some of it, when it said that the root cause of the problem is the absence of a comprehensive peace between Israel and its neighbors. That's the root cause. And then when the president came home 2 days later and briefed the Congress and the media and said that the root cause was terrorism, I think he had cause and effect turned around, frankly. And my view is that there is no military solution to this conflict. It's got to be a political solution. And By confusing cause and effect, it just makes it all the more difficult. And I think there will be violence until there is a comprehensive peace, just as a matter of fact.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Elaine Monahan with CQ. The first questioner stole my question, which is great because I get to ask my follow-up. You were answering about the concept of the war on terrorism and acts of evil and how that plays into this situation now. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about whether or not that backdrop has an impact directly on how the peacekeeping force operates in Lebanon. Do you think it's going to be a big topic in terms of managing relations with the local population, so on?
Volunteers?
I think there are going to be very different expectations on the part of the Israelis, the Americans, the Lebanese, the French, and Hezbollah as to exactly what this force is supposed to do. And the language that's used in the resolution, while apparently quite robust, is limited, since the only independent authority of the force is to support the government of Lebanon, and the government of Lebanon is likely to interpret the mandate and its own responsibilities rather narrowly and rather conservatively.
Okay.
I think that will become clear when they try to draft the concept of operations.
Ümit Enginsoy with Turkish NTV Television. Part of my question has already been answered, but I still would like to have a few more comments on a potential Turkish participation in the Lebanon force. Ambassador Mack briefly mentioned that, but do you think sectarian differences between Turkey and Hezbollah could create problems? Any downsides or any particular advantages for Turkish participation in that force? Whoever wants to answer.
Well, the main downside is the force is likely to be unsuccessful, and therefore they're going to be at least unsuccessful in the terms that expectations have been created in this country, and therefore one would be associated with an unsuccessful enterprise. Otherwise, I don't think the force is likely to become embroiled in serious conflict, and therefore I think the actual risks to the individuals involved are fairly low.
And I would just add to that for your Turkish audience, I don't really think that this would be something that would set off a renewal of the Safavid Ottoman Shia-Sunni divide in the area. There's plenty of other problems that are going to have to be dealt with before, you know, that would be a really serious impediment. And I would say again that there's the effectiveness of the force, effectiveness of the Turkish armed forces, that would be the critical determinant of whether they'd be successful down there. Yeah, please, Mike.
The flip side of Ambassador Dobbins is if you don't have capable forces within the UN force, it will fail. So from that perspective, Turkish participation is essential. Is it is regional, and they're effective, and they're capable, and they will get Hezbollah's attention.
Ahram newspaper. Excuse me, could you speak a little closer to the microphone there, Dawood?
My name is Khaled Dawood. I'm from Egypt, Al-Ahram newspaper, and I had actually two questions for Ambassador Dobbins. The first one concerning the structure of the force. Don't you think that this is a rather huge force, considering that even Secretary Rice was saying that the original mandate for the UNIFIL was like 7,000 or 8,000 troops, and they ended up with 2,000? So considering the space that they're supposed to deploy and previous experience, are we necessarily going to end up with 15,000 international forces besides the Lebanese army? And quickly, my second question, Mr. Terry Red Larson, the UN envoy, was here in Washington a few months ago, and he mentioned the possibility of integrating Hezbollah inside the Lebanese army as one possibility for ending this duality in the existence of to whatever forces inside Lebanon, and I wonder whether you wanted to comment on this as a possibility. Yeah.
And Jim, since I let Khaled violate my rule against two single questions, you can answer either question that you want, both if you're generous. Otherwise, he goes back to the end of the line for his second question.
I got the second.
Okay.
It deals with reintegration.
Okay, Michael, do the second one.
You know, it depends on what you want the force to do as to whether it's appropriately sized. It's too small to do what the United States and Israel want it to do. It may be too large to do what it's likely to actually be able to do, which is an enlarged observer force and a buffer to some degree that prevents raids, if not rockets. To give you a sense of scale, Lebanon is the same population as Bosnia. Bosnia had a force of 60,000. It's a third bigger than Kosovo. Kosovo had 50,000. So if the force was a peace enforcement force with a countrywide mandate, then it would be too small. Given that it's a limited geographic mandate for a peace enforcement force, it's probably a reasonable size, particularly if the Lebanese army was actually going to be robust and useful. On the issue of integration, I'll let my colleague respond. I would only say that the only way that Hezbollah is likely to meaningfully quote, disarm would be in a process of integration, but the integration would probably be largely nominal, and it would almost certainly retain its own command and control structures.
Mike?
Springboarding off his comments, the key point of that discussion of whether Hezbollah is integrated into the Lebanese army is incentive. We have to give Hezbollah something else to do. If we don't give them something else to do, that's honorable, that's credible, enables them to take care of their families, why would they want to stop what they're doing now? And the Lebanese Armed Forces is a viable option, but there is going to have to be some sort of process to screen and vet Hezbollah before they go in to the LAF to ensure that the LAF's credibility is not undermined. And that is, without that step, you then run into problems that we're encountering in Iraq with sectarian influence within the security sector. But the incentive, I cannot understate the need for an incentive. For Hezbollah, there has to be a credible, sustainable alternative to what they're doing right now.
Next questioner.
Zahir Imadi from the Syrian TV and radio. Israel record has a long history of Israel disrespecting the international lines and troops. It used disrespect on the Golan Heights when it sends its farmers to try to grab Syrian lands, and when the Syrians were trying to defend their lands. Now Israel to this day claims that the Syrians were bombing the Israelis from the top of the mountains while they were actually trying to defend their lands. Now in South Lebanon, Israel has also committed many massacres.
You got a question coming
in Canaan and other places. What do you do now, while you are forming these international troops? What can you do to make it so costly for Israel to commit another atrocity in the future?
Okay, good question. I don't see anything in the resolution that made it clear as to whether this robust UN force would be able to defend itself against the Israelis. But presumably, if you've got the French in there and the Turks in there, they're not going to sit back and take it the way UNIFIL did in some previous encounters with the Israeli armed forces. I would be inclined to think that the robustness of the force may impose a certain amount of respect on the decision makers in Tel Aviv, but other panelists may have some different views. Okay, that's the best effort.
Too reluctant when it comes to talking about Israeli violations. I mean, we like to hear. I mean, too reluctant to talk about what.
As a matter of fact, I'm not at all reluctant.
Not you, the other panels. Yeah. You have asked someone else to comment, but I don't hear any of them or see any of them coming forward.
No, his comments are well taken. With a capable force, a mandate and rules of engagement, the force is designed to be interpositional to prevent both sides from recommencing hostilities. It's an unenviable position that it has to prevent both sides. In these coming days, the discussions that are ongoing in Beirut are laying the groundwork for how that force, as previously discussed, is going to operate to accomplish that.
I mean, I just think that, you know, I would add to that this has obviously been one of the reasons why for a couple of decades now the Lebanese armed forces have not been willing to go down and take up their responsibilities along that border. It's not been simply because they didn't want to come into conflict with Hezbollah, but they didn't want to be in a position where they were going to be easy game for the Israelis either. But when they're sitting there side by side with this European force, I think they'd be able to be more assertive in maintaining order along that border.
Thank you.
Stephen Buck, Foreign Service Officer, retired. Just a question. It appears, at least from the press, that Hezbollah has come out as the victor in the Arab and Muslim world. If the position of Washington continues to be that this is all about disarming Hezbollah, how does that play in not only in our position, but also the Lebanese government's position?
Okay, Bill?
Yeah. I'm always in favor of taking conditions and trying to turn them to your advantage. And, I'm not a great expert in Lebanon, but I've been reading a lot of the profiles of Hassan Nasrallah, which I'm surprised we haven't really talked much about his background and personality. But and maybe it's not a correct analogy, but let's face it. Right now, Hezbollah is kind of like the football team that was expected to lose. You know, it was much weaker than its opponent and kind of pulled it out at the end. So suddenly there's a tremendous amount of respect. But, you know, when you come out of a game like that, and I've played in a couple like that, you don't want to have a rematch next week. You know, this, I agree with what Ambassador Dobbins said. You can't say Israel won on this, but probably that you don't want to fight again right away because there was a good deal of suffering and there may be a lot of recriminations about what they helped to bring down upon Lebanon. So I would think that what we really need to be looking at is maximizing the effect that now they suddenly are in this position of respect throughout the Arab world and play that. You know, don't just call them terrorists. Don't denigrate them. You know, give them their so-called victory and use that to help to give them a reason now if they don't want to go right back into that rematch. Give them a reason to transform. You know, and they're going to want to continue, of course, to have influence in Lebanese society. But let's give them a reason to transform.
I hope the White House is listening to you.
Okay, we do have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Dan Lieberman. UNIFIL is responsible for protecting the border, protecting any actions between the two parties. But what happens with violations of sovereignty? Flying airplanes, as Israel has, over Lebanese lands and also bringing ships close to shore. And Israel has indicated that they might try to actually assassinate Hezbollah leaders. Now, what will happen in that case?
As I said, a force of this kind is designed to prevent mistakes and misadventures. It's not designed to prevent an intentional resumption of hostility on either side. All it's going to do in that case is document who was responsible. If Hezbollah raiders are going across the international zone, they'll make enough noise so the Israelis know they're coming. But they're not in all likelihood going to physically shoot them. And by the same token, if the Israelis rocket or make an attack into Lebanon, this force is not going to shoot down the Israeli planes or shoot the Israeli soldiers. They'll simply document the transgression.
Just a point of fact, too. The last time that Israel killed a Hezbollah leader, they got Nasrallah as his replacement, and also Hezbollah blew up the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires.
Okay, with that, I think we'll bring this session to a conclusion. Please join me in a round of applause for our experts.